This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also download off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is Maria Conchon, a professor of public affairs and social work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and co-editor of an important recent book entitled Changing Poverty, Changing Policies from the Russell Sage Foundation. Maria Conchon, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. I'm glad to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your background and where you grew up and why you decided to take the path you took.
Well, I grew up in lots of different places all over the United States and spent quite a bit of time in Mexico as well. But I went to graduate school to study economics, and I had actually worked at the World Bank and studied low-income families in other countries. And
what was the World Bank like?
It was interesting. I went there thinking... Working there changed my perspective. It helped me to understand that people that work in organizations often have very different ideas than those of us outside of them think, and that organizations themselves have their own dynamics.
It was enlightening. I mean, I knew a guy who taught me economics who was a real progressive, and he got there and he just couldn't leave because the benefits were so great. It was kind of like a golden cage there. But you got out.
I got out. I didn't have my PhD when I started there. So it was less of a golden cage for someone who didn't have a PhD. I think it also had a model that wasn't, I had spent a lot of time living and working in Mexico, and I really felt like I understood the country at least a little bit. And I felt like my understanding of the problems there was very much informed by my understanding of the country and its culture. And so one of the things you need to do to work at a place like the World Bank, not everybody, but most people, is to kind of have an expertise but transfer it from one location to another. And I guess I didn't feel like that really called to me.
And that is the cookie-cutter approach that the World Bank and even more so the IMF have been criticized for over and over again.
Right. So I learned from being there that has applied to my later work is understanding that I think as a young person who'd studied a lot of radical theory about international development in college, I thought the World Bank would be populated by badly intentioned people, and I found it to be mostly populated by very well-intentioned people who were very constrained by the structures that they worked in. And I think I find some of the same things in studying U.S. Welfare programs that, I would say even the people with whom I have major disagreements about policy, we usually agree on where we'd like to end up. We just have fairly different ideas about how to get there.
Well, let's talk about that, Maria Conchon, because I am more suspicious, at least going back to Bill Clinton and ending welfare as we know it, about how well-intentioned that was. Maybe the people who were implementing it at its inception were well-intentioned. I don't think Bill Clinton was well-intentioned.
Right.
I think he did that for crass political purposes and either didn't really care how it ended up or was unable to control how it ended up. And as a result, in my opinion, poor people right now in the midst of this deep recession are really suffering. But what was your assessment or is your assessment of the ending welfare as we know it policy?
Well, I think that there were two sets of disagreements and two sets of predictions. And one set of disagreement was about how many people there were who were trapped by welfare as opposed to helped by welfare. And I think people on all sides of the debate recognized that there were aspects of the old system that kept some people who would like to be working more from being able to move ahead. And those were people whose family situations were sufficiently uncomplicated and who had job skills and who lived in environments in cities or in places where they had access to jobs. And they were essentially trapped by things like they would lose their benefits or they'd lose their health care. They wouldn't have access to child care benefits if they were working. So there's a group of people that were in that situation. Then there were a group of people who, and they were clearly made better off by the welfare reform. Then there's a group of people, if you will, at the bottom, who really are not able to be engaged in the labor market. And I think if you spend a lot of time with any individual one of these families, pretty much everybody would agree that they're not in a position to do that. And those people were not particularly well served by the old welfare system because it wasn't a generous system. But they were certainly, better protected by the old system than they are now.
And why were they unable to participate in the labor market?
A lot of people who relied on AFDC and currently rely on TANF have health and mental health issues. They have children who really need them to be at home. Those health and mental health issues often aren't either sufficiently documented, or they don't sometimes have the capacity to advocate for themselves to get on SSI or other benefits that ought to be covering disabilities. And so they're kind of caught without enough of a safety net. And I think even the people who implemented the most aggressive forms of welfare reform recognized that there were some of those people. They disagreed. I would have arguments with them about how many people are trapped on the high end. They want to be working. They want to get off welfare and they can't. And how many people are stuck at the bottom and they're really going to be hurt. Then there's a big group of people in the middle whose personal judgment or decision is that they would rather be home taking care of their kids, they'd rather be combining informal work with a welfare benefit, and that's a big group of people that I think people disagree on kind of ideological and theoretical grounds on, you know, what should the system be doing.
And you focus on that group a lot, Maria.
Focus on that group a lot, and also on trying to figure out the best way to help people who really are who are in all of those groups. So I would say one of the biggest there's a big disagreement when welfare reform was implemented. A lot of us thought that there would be a lot of people out on the streets and a lot of people wouldn't be able to get jobs. And I think critics of the reform, myself included, have been surprised by how many moms actually managed to find jobs and how much labor force participation increased. On the other hand, I think the proponents of welfare felt like if women just got a job, they just got a foot in the door, then everything, you know, it would just be a natural progression to the middle class. And I think they have also been wrong. We have very little evidence of people. There's stories of individual people, but on the whole, people have made a transition to unstable work, and they've made a transition, if it's to stable work, it's to low-paying work.
So TANF hasn't been a ladder to the middle class for most people.
No.
And even though those statistics, the happier statistics were gathered during a time of economic progress, mm-hmm. and growth, and now we're in quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think we have, you could be encouraged by kind of the extent to which people have entered the workforce, and to the extent that we believe in this country that part of being a citizen is working, doing the most you can for yourself. I think the welfare reforms in that way have been successful. But to the extent that we want work to be a way to have a decent standard of living, and we want parents who are doing what we expect of them to be able to provide reasonably for their children, I think our system doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And a big focus of the book is trying to think about, okay, now that we see that getting people off of welfare, you might think that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it clearly didn't get us all the way to where we need to be. What are the sets of policies and supports that we need to make it possible for people who are doing the best they can to actually have decent prospects for themselves and for their kids?
I'm speaking with Maria Conchon. The book she's referring to is Changing Poverty, Changing Policies by the Russell Sage Foundation, that she is the co-editor of with Stephen Danziger, right?
Sheldon Danziger.
I wanted to ask briefly before we get into those policies that might help people, just the ideological shift, because I noticed in this book that when Nixon was implementing welfare policy, he said the policy was not going to, we're not going to want to have new moms enter the workforce. We want them to stay with their kids. Something mm-hmm. dramatic happened between that and ending welfare as we know it. What was that?
Well, we have, I think, completely redefined what it means to be a good mother. So I think it used to mean to stay home with your kids and take care of them. And we have now said that being a good parent is providing economically. And being a good mother means, for some people, working at McDonald's. And I think it's really important. I'm glad you highlighted that shift, because I think sometimes when we tell the policy story, we tell a story of, well, we designed AFDC and we didn't really know what we were doing, so we created a program that had all these disincentives for people to work. And then we figured it out and we realized we needed a different kind of policy. When in fact, it isn't just that people didn't know what they were doing. It's that they had a different goal in mind. The goal was to allow moms to stay home and take care of their children when they were what we used to call deprived of father's support. And we've really changed. And to some large extent, I think that probably reflects the fact that more and more women across the spectrum are working. And so to the extent that middle-class women feel like they need to be in the labor market to help support their families, it's less accepting that low-income moms shouldn't be.
But from a developmental standpoint of the child, it may not be the best thing to force them out. Some of these policies force them out after how many weeks of the child being born?
Generally, so let me just use Wisconsin as an example. There are benefits here that allow a woman to stay home until her child is 12 weeks old. So, and that's modeled after the Family Medical Leave Act, which guarantees women no maternity benefits, but at least in some situations, an opportunity to return to their job after 12 weeks of leave. I think there's really mixed evidence about the extent to which women working or not is beneficial or not to their kids. I think we know a lot, however, about the contexts that make it more or less likely for that to be a good thing. And clearly one of the really key issues is having appropriate places for kids to be if they're not at home. And so to the extent that children are in high quality childcare, they're going to have much, much better outcomes than if they are in kinds of situations that women can afford if they're working for $6 or $8 or even $10 an hour.
Well, right. I mean, a lot of these poor moms cannot afford high quality childcare. And so they, what happens to the kid? They leave the latchkey kid. They leave the kid with a relative or a sibling, maybe a young, you know, a sibling who's 8 years old.
Exactly. No, and I think one of the things that maybe takes a lot of people by surprise is that a work-based approach to kind of a safety net is actually often more expensive, not less expensive. And that's because, for example, often the cost of paying for decent childcare for a woman who's going to be in a work placement is much more than what it would cost to send that person a welfare check. So the average childcare benefits in a lot of states are considerably higher than what their maximum welfare benefit was.
But in some states, they're considerably lower. They just took advantage of the requirement not being there that you have to, you know, pay for childcare, you have to pay for transportation, the job, and just, you know, are providing a bare minimum.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think there's been a lot of debate in the context of the current economic crisis. There's been a lot of debate even among kind of progressive folks who work on welfare issues about what's the best thing to do right now, given that funding is so tight and that there, you know, a lot of states are pulling back on childcare. Should we kind of loosen up the standards for providing kind of cash, traditional cash welfare? And I think there's a tension between some people who feel like right now what we need to do is get families, you know, make sure they have at least the minimum of what they need in the kind of the least expensive way possible. And other people, and I think I would be one of them, who really worry that we will phase out childcare benefits and we'll phase out other work supports now, kind of in the short term. And then in the longer term, we won't find the resources to phase them back in. Because I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that there have been clearly been a lot of downsides to kind of losing the entitlement to cash assistance, the right that women had, if all else failed, to some basic guarantee to help them provide for their families. But on the other hand, we've seen very substantial increases in childcare. We've seen substantial increases in kind of wage supplements like the earned income tax credit. We've seen substantial expansions in the availability of public health insurance through Medicaid and SCHIP, things like Badger Care in Wisconsin. And those are important victories. They're partial victories. They're not, they don't kind of get us everything we'd want, and they're not perfectly integrated. But we don't want to lose what we've gained, even as we're trying to figure out ways to make it better.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. My guest today, Maria Conchon. She's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and co-editor with Sheldon Danziger of Changing Poverty, Changing Policies, a relatively new book put out by the Russell Sage Foundation. You have written that the Obama stimulus package included some positives as far as this group of people that we're talking about. What were some of those?
An increase in the food stamps benefit, quite a bit more child care, money for child care, expansions for Head Start and early Head Start. Those were all important pieces. I think another piece that it's a partial, it hasn't kind of been as broad as we might have liked to see, but has been part of the unemployment modernization efforts have included some what I would consider kind of updating and family-friendly changes, including, for example, allowing people to qualify for unemployment insurance when they've left employment for compelling family reasons. So we have an unemployment insurance system, which is really very different from welfare. People usually aren't embarrassed to get an unemployment insurance check. It's a very different, it's not nearly as intrusive of a system to qualify for unemployment insurance as it is to qualify for welfare. So it's a system in a lot of ways that we would like to see more people have access to as an alternative to welfare. But it's really based on an idea of what work is that is really outdated. It's an idea that people have a job, they work for the same employer, they work the same hours, they get a steady income, they get laid off for a particular reason, a plant closing or something like that, that's very easy to identify. And the unemployment insurance system is not really well suited to people whose hours vary a lot, who might be working part-time because of family responsibilities, who might have to leave the labor market, say, in the summer when their kids are home from school. And it also doesn't recognize that there are reasons beyond the control of a worker, beyond just a plant closing. If you're a single parent and a worker and you have a child with a health concern, or you're a mom and you give birth, those are reasons that you have to be out of the labor market that are very different from the ones that we worried about when we developed the unemployment insurance system.
And so one of the things you talk about is the need for paid sick leave, paid family leave, paid paternity leave, I imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the issues I think that we still need to grapple with, we kind of set up a welfare reform and a whole set of social policies with this, if you will, a new vision of what it meant to be a responsible parent, which was to go out and provide for your children. Now, this is in the context of a reality where most children in the United States will spend at least some time living in a household that doesn't include both of their parents. So about 40% of children last year were born to mothers who were not married. So they start out life, generally speaking, in a family either living just with their mom, or if their dad is around, he's not likely to be around for all that long. And then a lot of families that have children, when they're married, end up divorcing. So you have a lot of women, because usually children end up living with their moms, a lot of women who are in the labor market, and they're also either the sole or at least the primary provider of care for their children. And so we have a lot of expectations for those moms, what we expect from them. We expect them to leave their job and pick their kids up when their kids are sick. We expect them to get their children to the doctor often under hours that are within the working day. We expect them to tend to their children's school needs. But we also expect them to be good workers. And we haven't really come to grips with the incompatibility of our ideals for what it means to be a mom and or a parent, but it's often the mom who's trying to balance these two things, and what it means to be a worker. And I think the biggest challenge is that people like me that work in professional jobs, I have paid sick leave. I have actually a fairly flexible schedule. And I also earn enough money that if I need to, I can pay for that specialty clinic that will see my kid after working hours. Or I can pay for a babysitter to stay home when my kids are sick. Or I can stop by the kind of fast casual restaurant and pick up dinner if I don't have time between everything else. Low-income moms are likely to not count on any of those supports. They often find themselves in jobs that have no paid sick leave. They often not only don't have flexible schedules, but they often don't have predictable schedules. So trying to set up the kind of childcare when you don't know from week to week what hours you're going to have to work is really difficult.
And you pointed out that they work in places under 50 employees, so they're not They can't take family leave, maternity leave,
right,
even unpaid.
Right. They're often working in places that aren't subject to some of the Family and Medical Leave Act and other things. And I think we haven't kind of come to grips with the disjuncture between those things. So we see some of these things like guaranteed sick leave, some people do, as kind of bonuses, like a frill or something that would be kind of a high-end benefit, without recognizing that they're absolutely critical if we expect the same person to be providing all the income for a family, or most all the income for their family, and being the primary caretaker.
And then, some people in society would then blame this single mom for either being a bad mom or a bad worker. I mean, you say it is very hard for them to meet these ideals. And from my observation, these are not even ideals for them. They're just crushing demands on them,
right,
that they can't fulfill.
Right. No, and I think, one of the things that so I do mostly quantitative research. I don't talk. I don't have that many opportunities to spend a lot of time talking with people that are participating in these programs, though I do spend some time doing that. But I think one of the things that is most striking from my colleagues who do research and spend a lot of time with moms who are in this situation is that often the behaviors that we interpret as somebody being kind of not a good worker or an irresponsible employee, those workers are seeing as, my first responsibility is to my child. And if my child is sick, I need to stay home and take care of that kid. Or if, I get a phone call in the middle of the day from school, I need to get there. If you see it through the lens of being a parent, it's very different from if you look at it through the lens of being an employee.
Yeah, my wife's a Head Start nurse, and she sees these parents all the time, and she says they're wanting to be, good moms, but they have to, go to their job, and sometimes public transportation takes an hour and a half, two hours to get to and from their job, and it's tough.
Right, and those contextual factors, I think, are also things we don't pay enough attention to. So on top of all the benefits and freedoms that a middle-class family often has, we often are driving to work, we are able to live closer to our work often, and, my kids can come home from school on their own because I live in a neighborhood where I don't have to worry about kind of what else is going on in the neighborhood and necessarily having quite as close an eye on them as somebody would if they were having to live in the kind of housing that they can afford on a job that pays $6 or $8 an hour.
How many kids do you have? How old are they?
Two. One in college and one in high school.
Oh, there
so
you go.
Now I don't worry as much.
Well, you're almost out of it, as I am. I'm speaking with Maria Conchon. She's a professor of public affairs and social work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, co-editor with Sheldon Danziger of Changing Poverty, Changing Policies, a book published by Russell Sage with a lot of really interesting things in there. So other than paid sick leave, paid family medical leave, what else can we do for this cohort of people?
Well, so one set of things we need to do is maintain policies like the earned income tax credit that we have, which serves to kind of supplement people's income. The other thing we need is health reform. That would do a lot for many people, but it would be very important for these families. I think the other thing we need to do is pay attention to dads. And so one of the things that is important is for us to figure out ways to both support fathers and require fathers to help provide for their children. And we have a system right now that is has some upsides, but there are a number of aspects of the current child support system that really are problematic. It's also the case that a lot of fathers who, because they don't have children in the household, they don't qualify for a lot of the programs. Not that they're such great programs, but there are some programs that help moms get job training, the earned income tax credit that helps make work pay for low-wage workers. Those kinds of things are generally not available or as available to fathers.
I didn't realize that the state skims off some child support until I read some of your writings on this. That seems like robbery from the mom's perspective.
Well, I think we have to really wonder what we're doing if we're taking money that is aimed for low-income children and using it instead to support government programs. So the way that it works currently, though this has been changing, is in most states, if a mother is receiving cash benefits and a father pays child support for those kids, the state actually keeps that money and doesn't pass it along to the kids. So no matter what the father pays, the kids aren't any better off. And as you can imagine, that's pretty frustrating for everybody involved. Most fathers who have had children with women who have low enough incomes to qualify for welfare aren't particularly well off themselves. So you have a very low-income man who's probably struggling at a job that doesn't pay particularly well. If he's working in the legal labor market, we take the child support straight out of his paycheck. So he sees it out of his paycheck, but mom doesn't see any of the money.
And if he's responsible, he wants it to go to mom or the child.
He wants it to go to...
It's frustrating for him, for the mom, and bad for the kid.
Right. And nowadays, when we really do have very limited welfare programs, one of the reasons why this is particularly a problem is that moms are only using welfare benefits for a very short period of time. But often that's at the very beginning of their child's life. And so at the very beginning when families are getting started, we're teaching them that if the father pays child support through the regular system, his kids aren't going to benefit. And he's going to have that obligation for 18 years, but we're sending exactly the wrong message at the beginning.
We only have a couple of minutes left, Maria Conchon, and I wanted to get to this question as to whether single motherhood itself is the problem. You mentioned that 40% of moms are single moms right now, and the right-wing conservatives say, well, we got to get at that problem. That's the root of all evil.
Well, so I'll put aside the question of whether if I could wave a magic wand, I would do away with people having children outside of marriage. That's, I think, another conversation, an interesting one to have. But I will say that I think we have very good evidence that government really is completely or almost completely ineffective at changing people's decisions about whether and when to get married and when to have children. Therefore, a lot of times people want to justify policies by saying, well, sure, this will hurt kids in the short run, but in the long run, we're going to get the incentives right so that women stop having children outside of marriage. And I think that is almost always a really bad way to think about public policy. I think we see changes in whether people are getting married and how many kids people have and when they have them. We see that across the income distribution. We see that among people who have absolutely no intention of ever receiving welfare. And we see it across lots of different developed countries that have very different welfare systems. So those are changes that reflect big changes in norms and gender roles and other things. And so to think that we're going to, for example, tell moms, you can't get welfare anymore, and they're going to then stop having children, I think is foolish. And it leaves those families very, very vulnerable.
And it's related to the cultural poverty argument that, you know, these problems are unsusceptible to public policy solutions.
Yeah.
And we have 20 seconds left. What's wrong with that?
Many things in 20 seconds. I guess maybe because I'm an economist by training, I tend to believe that people develop cultures or ways of dealing with the world that make sense, that are rational given the choices that they have. And we ought to worry more about making sure that people have good choices and less about the choices that they're making.
Well, that was good for 15 or 20 seconds. Maria Conchon, I couldn't have done that. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.